Hey, it's Christine with Storyworthy. Today on the show, comedian Ant talks all about his sobriety.
We opened up the fourth, the fifth, and the sixth beer, and I remember saying to myself, that day I will do whatever it takes to feel like this for the rest of my life. And then my drinking started to accelerate because my parents had a full bar in the house, although they rarely drank. And I was drinking their booze, and I was drinking my neighbor's booze. And then I started going to school, and I started drinking in school. And, you know, it was fun, and then it was fun with problems, and then it was just problems. Now, at the same time, I was graying out, I was browning out, and then I was blacking out. I was coming to in a cornfield 6 miles away from home, naked, and, you know, it would be 7 hours later.
Today on the show, comedian Ant talks all about gaining his sobriety. Stay close.
Hi, this is Ant, and you're listening to Storyworthy.
Welcome to Storyworthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm coming to you from Los Angeles, California. Whether you're a longtime fan of the show or a new listener, welcome to the show. I hope you got a chance to listen to comedian Katie Love last week. Now, Katie's story was about being a Jehovah's Witness and then getting married at 16 and then finally leaving the cult. But oh my gosh, what a story. And she wasn't born into the Jehovah's Witnesses, but check this out. Her mother had committed suicide when Katie was only 9, so she had to go live with her sister, who was a Jehovah's Witness. You believe that, Aunt?
Wow. That's just so weird. I don't know a lot about the religion of Jehovah's Witnesses, but I know that they don't celebrate parties, no Christmas, no Thanksgiving, so I'll take a pass.
That's exactly right. They do. There's no celebrations whatsoever. And the only thing they celebrate are weddings. And so Katie was talking about how they'll have a Jehovah's Witness wedding ceremony, and there'll be all these people there that you don't know just because they get to go out. So the wedding is full of the whole town. Yeah, the whole town comes.
Wow. I was in Las Vegas, Christine, once headlining at a club, and I brought some friends with me, and the hotel gave my room, my extra rooms away that I had booked for my friends.
Oh no!
And I said, why did you give up my rooms? And they were like, a convention was in town that was larger than we expected. We're so sorry. I said, well, what was the convention? They said, Jehovah Witness. And I said, in Vegas? And they're like, yeah, apparently there's a lot of sinners here. So they like to, you know, up their ranks when membership gets low. So I did my shows that night. And as I'm walking down the hallway, I'm realizing there's a Jehovah in this room. There's a Jehovah in that room. And me and my three friends are crammed in one room while they've got my rooms. So on a lark, I just knocked on one of the doors, and this guy answered half asleep, and he goes, can I help you? And I went, yeah, how does it feel? How does it feel? Here's a watchtower. That's what they do. They knock on our doors at all times of the day here in LA.
That is so funny. I think that is hilarious. Yeah. Now, I had a boyfriend before, a long time ago, who used to invite them in just to ask really challenging questions and just, you know, hear their responses just to find out, like, what are you thinking?
Right, exactly.
It's a
bizarre, I don't know. I can't get past the fact that they don't celebrate holidays. Yeah. I love eating.
Yeah, no kidding. So, I love parties in general. Yeah.
Although I'd probably lose a lot of weight if I were Jehovah's, since they don't celebrate anything.
Hey, listen, by the way, you look great. You are super fit right now, and you are looking really
You're
good.
You're so kind.
No, I'm serious.
I'm down 64 pounds. I'm down 64 pounds.
That is so impressive.
Doing good.
And I know you've been in the comedy world a long time. You've had a huge, long career and been on all sorts of shows. And you've been up and you've been down in your weight. And, you know, you hosted that Celebrity Fit Club for so long.
I was thin when I was hosting that show.
Yeah, didn't you learn so much?
No, apparently not, because when the show was canceled, I was making so much money hosting that show, and it was the easiest gig in the world. It was 3 hours of work on a Saturday and about 8 or 9 hours of work on a Sunday every other week, and I was making 55 grand a week. It was unbelievable. So it was easy to stay thin because they told me you can't be fatter than the contestants. And I said, okay, I will not be fatter than the contestants. And our first season, Ralphie May was one of our contestants. So I just made sure I stood next to Ralphie all the time, God rest his soul. And I always looked thin. So
that is hilarious.
But when that show got canceled, I went into a tailspin and put on a lot of weight and didn't even realize I was depressed. And then I did the show called The Doctors, where they sort of turned it all around for me by giving me a trainer and food program and psychotherapy. And, you know, I lost a bunch of weight doing that program. And then I've continued that journey and I'm down about a total of 64 pounds now in 2 years.
I think that is so stunning. I have like 10 questions right off the bat. Real quick, did Ralphie May do well on that show?
Ralphie lost, I want to say, either 30 or 40 pounds. He did well. In 6 weeks to lose that kind of weight, it's pretty good.
Yeah, that is a lot. Yeah, no kidding. If you think about, I always think about like pounds of cat food. You know what I mean? You carry three 10-pound bags of cat food around.
Yeah, I look at potatoes that way. I look at a 10-pound sack of potatoes and go, God, three of those. I was just carrying that. Awful.
So but it's just so interesting because you obviously learned on that show. I mean, I know you're saying it was easy and everything, but you obviously learned.
Well, you think you learn.
I know, but I'm just
saying.
You
think you learn.
When you started then gaining weight and going down that hole of eating a lot, obviously not exercising, you didn't see that as a problem at that time, or you thought I'll turn it around, or was the depression that bad? I mean, what was it?
Well, once you get into the fuck-its,
yeah,
it's sort of hard to like come out of it unless you've got like a support system in place. I didn't have a support system in place and I wasn't telling people what was going on and I had the fuck-its and that was a deadly combination.
Oh, and I am so glad you're okay now. And you've been sober for how long?
Me too. I'm on top of the world. Say that again.
How long have you been sober?
Well, I have not had a drug or a drink. It'll be 10 years this April.
Unbelievable. That is so exciting. Congratulations. Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. From a diehard crystal meth heroin junkie.
Unreal.
To being on top of the world.
Wow.
Life is grand.
I am so happy you are here, man. I'm telling you, I bet I could get 10 shows out of you with the stories you have. And I'm super excited about your topic because you bring to the table today sobriety. So I'm really anxious to hear this story. I think about, you know, the people that I know that are sober and how happy they are. And I also know people that probably should get sober. And then I probably should get sober. I mean, I am sober, but I mean, like, I've never had to have a drink, but I'd want a drink. You know what I mean? It's not like I don't want a beer at lunch with fries and a chicken sandwich. Who wouldn't want a beer at lunch with fries and a chicken sandwich or whatever? You know what I mean?
Sweetie, I didn't need the fries or the chicken sandwich. I just wanted the beer.
Yeah.
Fuck the food. You know, that was my...
And that's where, I mean, obviously there's a difference in terms of who is an alcoholic, what does an alcoholic look like versus somebody who just drinks a lot who probably shouldn't because they're gaining weight. Or I mean, I'm not sure where the line is drawn. I mean, is the line drawn like technically if you can't do your job or you start letting people down, or do you know how to define that?
I can tell you for me what it means. Alcoholism is a self-diagnosed disease that tells you you don't have it.
Wow.
For me. That's what it means for me.
That is something else.
Yeah.
Good. I want to talk about this. And so your sobriety was part of that through the doctors or was that different?
No. That was weight loss was through the doctors and sobriety was because I lost everything sort of, you know, I lost myself. I just lost my family. My friends weren't talking to me and that's where sobriety.
Oh my gosh. Well, I am so excited to talk to you about this, but before we start your story, I did want to remind everybody that we are playing Story Smash, the storytelling game show every Friday night, live and streaming on Facebook and YouTube at 7 o'clock Pacific time. And you would be such a wonderful judge. You're going to have to come on as an expert judge and play this game. Basically, I get four comedians to come on and they spin a wheel and tell a true story on whatever they land on. The story should be is either 1 minute or 2 minutes long and there's a clock. And then we go to the expert judges to to comment. And Blanca Patch is on pretty much every week. And Danny Zucker. Last week, Melissa Peterman was on, and Greg Proops.
Oh, love Melissa.
Oh, she's so fantastic. And Mary Lynn Ricecup comes on, and Felicia Michaels. And we have such a ball. Wendy McLennan Covey was on last week. Aunt, you'd fit right into the mix.
I'd love to
do it. So you'll have to come on the show.
I'd love to do it.
Oh, good. I'll book you. When we're done today, I'm going to book you for that. So coming soon, you guys. And is going to be on Story Smash. We are laughing our ass off every week. No tickets needed. Head over to storysmashshow.com to get more information and follow Story Smash on Instagram at Story Smash. All right, you guys, he's here right now. And, oh, by the way, we have one more thing in common, Aunt. Well, we have one thing in common for sure. We were both flight attendants.
Oh, my God. I was a flight attendant for many, many years.
I was for 7 years. How long were you?
11.
Wow. You were making good money, weren't you?
And I hated every minute of it. I hated it. Yeah, I was ACL.
Yeah.
I hated every minute of it, Christine. I would have been the best flight attendant if it weren't for one thing.
People.
Passengers.
I knew you were going to say that.
People would stop you in the aisle and go, excuse me, do you have a deck of cards? And I'm like, this is a 747, not a 7-Eleven. Hello, no.
How about how much stuff we gave out? Pillows, blankets, magazines.
Not me. I was so mean. People would be like, do you have a pillow? I'm like, at home on my bed.
They must
have. And I would just stare them down.
Oh, I bet they love you.
I was so mean. Meanest flight attendant. Meanest.
Remember? Do you remember, though, that they smoked on the planes? I mean, people were smoking.
Yeah.
It was unreal.
Yeah, back then in the 80s.
Yeah.
In the 80s, and they had that invisible, like, up to row 15 was non-smoking, and then row 16 was smoking. As if the smoke knew it couldn't pass row 15.
We'd be on, like, a shitty DC-9 that had 8 people in first class, 4 could smoke, and 4 couldn't.
And 4 couldn't. Exactly. Or we would go to we would be on the DC-10 or the L-10-11. We would go to the lower lobe galley and smoke and drink.
God, I always say that. Mm-hmm. I always say that I would do international because I like the flight attendants who did international, because after the meals were served, we'd go back in the galley, pull the curtain, turn the meal card over and put blankets and pillows on it and play cards and gamble.
And play cards and gamble. And oh, we had so much fun.
That's what I'm saying. That was fun. Yeah. And some of the overnights, right? I mean, you had to have had a blast.
Oh my God. Well, I was in international. I was LA, Paris. I was L.A., London. I had some really great flying. I was lucky because I spoke French. So I got great routes.
That's so interesting. How did you learn French? Who taught you that?
Oh, I scammed the test. There was a Frenchie in my flight attendant class, and he basically taught us all the phrases that we were going to be asked on the test. So I didn't really speak French, but I can say, le commandant d'abord requestez-vous, I can't remember. Le commandant d'abord requestez-vous attacher vos ceintures de sécurité. Attach your connect your seatbelts. Yeah.
That makes me laugh so hard because honestly, I thought I heard all the airline stories and I never heard that.
Oh yeah, I scanned it. I did not know a lick of French.
Hey man, remember when we used to collect cash on the planes, all the money that came in?
I'm the reason why they don't allow cash on planes anymore, because I used to steal it to pay my mortgage.
That's what I'm saying. Now, I'm not saying I stole money, but there's a guy in Marina Del Rey with a boat called Headsets.
That's the best. Yeah. Mine was Headset and liquor money.
Mm-hmm. Liquor money. $4, $4,
$3, $4, $4, $4.
Right. And then you do a 4-day trip and you have $800 in your pocket easily.
Plus your tax-free per diem. Hello.
Unbelievable. That is so funny. And we could go on and on about that. I'm telling you.
Yeah.
But boy, you really have had a rich life. You've been a regular guest on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno and also The Tyra Banks Show. Mm-hmm. And you're the only comedian to appear in all 5 seasons of NBC's hit series, Last Comic Standing.
Yep.
And you were the host of VH1 Celebrity Fit Club and in the Logo series, US of Ant. I don't remember US of Ant.
It was on Logo, which was at that time, they had original programming. Now all they air is RuPaul's Drag Race, I think. But yeah, it was one of the first original series that launched that network. was MTV's logo.
That is really interesting. And you also have a stand-up DVD called Ant, America's Ready, and a comedy CD called Follow My Ass.
Yeah, that was from being a flight attendant.
Yeah, because you would say, you're supposed to say, like, you know, leave your bags, bring it, come this way, leave your bag, come this way. And you would say,
I would say, follow my fucking ass. And I would jump out of the plane first, because if I'm in a plane crash and I live, you're all going to die. I'm not going to stay there and help you get off that plane. You asked for a whole can of Coke. I already hate you.
You made me take your baby's diaper to the bathroom. I hate you already. So if you want to follow my ass, I'm going this way. I hear you, brother.
Thank you.
And you have been a headliner in Las Vegas, which must be an incredible feeling.
All over the world.
And yeah, you have just had such a career. You guys can find more about Ant at theant.com and also follow Ant on Twitter at AntComic. All right, you guys, wherever you are, put your hands together for Ant.
Thanks, Christine. So I grew up in New Hampshire, which is the whitest state in the nation. I mean, literally the whitest state in the nation. Our foreign exchange students in high school are from Detroit. Jackie and Mavis Brown, these two black girls. And they brought black girls in because we had never seen black people before. And I was called sissy and faggot and queer, and I was stuffed in lockers and stuff. But when those two twins came to my town, my life changed. One day, Dave McLean was trying to stuff me in a locker, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, four big black boobies appeared. They grabbed him by the nape of the neck, and they hurled him into outer space, and he exploded. That's a true story, but I digress. I grew up in New Hampshire, and there was really nothing to do in New Hampshire, and nobody was really educating us kids about like stuff that we were seeing on TV and stuff. And one day, my best friend, Richard Scalfani, stole a Playboy magazine and a six-pack of Michelob Light from his dad's garage. And him and Mike Aikwin and Nick Grebe and I went into my tree fort, which was faggotized for your protection. It had twinkly lights. Oh. I had a bedroom set in there. I had a dinette. I mean, faggotized for your protection. And we opened up that first beer and we passed it around. We opened up the second beer and the third beer and we passed it around. And all of a sudden, life was good. And I got that feeling. And you all listening know that feeling that drinking and downing three beers will get you pretty quickly. And life was great. And I didn't know I was different until they opened up that Playboy magazine. Now, there's young people listening. Magazines are papers that are stapled in the middle. And you don't need your thumb to read them. You actually use your eyes. But I digress. So they opened up that Playboy magazine, and Playboy had the centerfold, and it would fall out of the middle of the magazine. And my friends were like, "Oh my God, look at those! Look at that!" And I'm like, "Look at her manicure! Good Lord, why is she naked on the beach? I don't even understand the magazine." But it didn't matter because we opened up the fourth, the fifth, and the sixth beer, and I got drunk. And I remember saying to myself that day, "I will do whatever it takes to feel like this for the rest of my life."
Wow.
And then my drinking started to accelerate because my parents had a full bar in the house, although they rarely drank. And I was drinking their booze and I was drinking my neighbor's booze. My friends would invite us over. And then I started going to school and I started drinking in school. And, you know, it was fun. And then it was fun with problems. And then it was just problems. Now, at the same time, I was starting to get graying out. I was browning out. And then I was blacking out. And nobody was talking to us kids about alcohol or its effects. Nobody. So I had no idea that I was, coming to in a cornfield 6 miles away from home, naked. And, you know, it would be 7 hours later. And I had no idea what it was. I had no idea because no one was talking to us about the effects of alcohol. And, you know, I would wake up in strange cities. I would wake up in various states of undress. I would wake up. It would be 3 hours later or 5 hours later. And growing up in New Hampshire at the same time, Christine, there was this TV show called In Search Of, and it was hosted by Leonard Nimoy. And every week, the show was about people who had close encounters of the first kind, people close encounters of the second kind, people who'd seen UFOs, people who had talked to aliens. And one day, this guy looked right at the camera as I'm watching the show, and he goes, "Here's how you can tell if you're being abducted by aliens. You wake up in strange places." And I thought, oh my God. You've lost time. I thought, what? And you're in various states of undress. And I thought, motherfucker. motherfucker. And I sat my mom and my dad down and I said, you're not going to believe this. I go, but I think a master alien race has been abducting me to learn about humanity and our culture. And my parents looked at me and they were like, what the fuck is wrong with you? And they put me in therapy right away. And never once did the therapist ever say, hey, are you drinking or smoking anything funny? Because if they had, I really think I might have gotten help a lot quicker. But he didn't. So what happened for me is the drinking and the using got worse and worse and worse. And my parents had had it. They had taken as much as they were going to take, and they took me to court. And they asked a judge to emancipate me, which would make me a legal adult at 16 years old. And the judge agreed with them. And the judge emancipated me. So now I'm a legal adult. I don't have to do a thing my parents tell me.
Can I stop you 1 second? I got to stop you 1 second. This is an unbelievable story. Do you have brothers and sisters?
I do. I have an older brother and two sisters. One of them has passed away.
Okay. And they were around. Were they okay in school?
Oh, they were all great.
So you were really problematic. So the first time you were in that treehouse and you started drinking beers, how old were you?
11.
11. So 11 to 16.
Oh, 11 to 16. Oh, but mind you, from 11 to 16, I had discovered marijuana and cocaine.
Wow, man. That seems so strange in the middle of New Hampshire. I guess not.
Seemed normal to me.
Okay. Go ahead. This is great.
Yeah. So 16, I'm emancipated. So I decide I'm going to move to Los Angeles. So I moved to LA and I discovered West Hollywood and I start running with a really fast gay crowd. And when you're 16 and have a six pack and a full thick head of black hair and hazel eyes and you're young and you're attractive, there's no such thing as needing an ID to get into a gay bar. So it was at this after-hours bar on Highland Avenue called The Probe. That's what gay men call their bars, Probe. The lesbians call their bars Angels, Feathers. The gay men, Probe, Ramrod, Shaft, Nail. We really drive the point home, you know? And it's 3:30 in the morning, and this tall, gorgeous Nordic Latino looks at me and he goes, you look a little tired. And I went, well, it's 3:30 in the morning. I'm kind of tired. And he sticks this bullet thing under my nose and he says, inhale deep. And that was my first experience with crystal methamphetamine. And the only other thing I remember that night was I'm shirtless, I'm dancing on a box, I can't stop moving, and I have an incredible urge to vacuum the ceiling. That was my first experience on meth. And my life spiraled out of control at that point. And that drinking and that using lasted a long, long time. And the alcoholism and the drug addiction that lives within me is slow. It is patient, it is persistent, and it wants me dead, but it will settle for miserable. And I lost pretty much almost everything, except I got lucky. One night, I saw my life as it really was. And mind you, I'd been 5153 times, Christine. For those of you that are listening on the East Coast, it's the Baker Act. Here in California, it's 5150, where they involuntarily commit you if they think that you are a danger to yourself or to others. And when you're on crystal meth, there's a lot of paranoia. There's a lot of, you know, there's just a lot of cuckoo craziness that happens in your own brain and you don't trust anything and you think people are out to get you. There's tree people living in the trees. The FBI is spying on you. The salt shakers have cameras and sound recording devices in them, which I still really do believe they do. You know, there's just a lot of that craziness. And I had been 5153 times, and this is the insanity of my life. On the third time, as I was being discharged, the nurse who was discharging me was handing me back my belt and my shoelaces, because they don't want you to hang yourself, and my dignity. And he looked at me and he said, do you want your vacuum cleaner back? And I said, excuse me? And he said, oh yeah, when you checked in, you wouldn't let us check you in unless she came along with you. And that explains my life with drugs. I get sexually involved with small household appliances when I'm high and speaking on crystal meth.
Oh, and wait a minute. What kind of vacuum? It was like a Dustbuster. It was like a Hoover upright.
It's a Hoover, the best brand there is for suction. So I got to tell you, Christine, I was at the bottom.
Okay, but I have to ask you something. Was the guy that gave you the crystal meth, the first guy that gave that to you that night in the bar, did he become your friend? Is that the crowd you ran with? How did you pay for it?
I didn't have to pay for it. He just gave it to me. It was one hit. It was my first time ever using it. And that kept me up for like three nights. I never saw him again.
God.
Yeah.
You never saw him again. You knew where to get more?
Oh, God, of course. That bar was known for it.
I see.
Known for it. I didn't know that until I did it for the first time. And then I went looking for it. And in the gay community, it's very easy to find crystal meth. Very easy.
Yeah. Had you known anybody who had experienced it and died from it? I mean, did you know how dangerous it was? Or did you think like, fuck it, I'm just doing it?
I didn't ever think about the danger. I only thought about how it made me feel.
Wow.
I never once thought of alcoholic and drug addicts don't ever think about consequences.
I see.
That's why when people beg them, please stop drinking, please stop using, we make empty promises because we're incapable of telling the truth and we're incapable of making a real promise because we have a disease that tells us we have to keep doing it. We are powerless over that stuff.
It is just devastating. Yeah, that is just devastating. Did anybody else in your family know anything going on, but did they know what was going on?
Christine, if I hadn't been a drug addict and an alcoholic, I wouldn't have the life I have today, which is blessed. That experience and going through that journey taught me more about me and gave me this life that is filled with service to others. That is why it was not the worst thing that could have ever happened to me.
Wow. The
thing that ever happened to me was my sister being killed and my dad dying too young.
Yeah.
This was a life experience. Because I was born with this disease of alcoholism,
yeah.
Which you treat it, you can go on to live a happy, productive, blessed, full life. And that's exactly what happened to me.
Wow.
A friend that I first moved when I got to LA, I told him, I said, you know what? I think I've got a drug problem and a drinking problem. I don't know how to stop. And he said, I can help. He took me to a group of people who were suffering from the same thing that I'm suffering from. My journey into recovery began. And for that, I am eternally grateful. So if you have listeners that are struggling with substance abuse issues, there's help.
Are there like two or three or four people that right off the top of your head, you think to yourself like, okay, they saved my life?
Oh God, yeah.
Yeah.
I have my friend, Steve L., who is my Eskimo. Person that got me into recovery and introduced me to that group of people, about him. And I think about the mentors in my life. There have been several. One is JW. Another one is David L. These are people who, David M. These are people who role model behavior for me, who teach me how to be the best version I can be, who have taught me about spiritual tools and how to live life that is other-centered instead of self-centered.
And so,
you know, for comedians, yeah. That's hard.
Right.
But, we're self-centered to the extreme.
So did you ever graduate high school? Did you do that?
I did graduate high school after getting a GED.
Mm-hmm, that was good. And then when you were 18, 19, you were just out here in LA going wild.
Going crazy. For many,
going crazy.
Many years.
Yeah. So now, when did you like get serious about comedy? And I'm asking in a professional way because you can't be that fucked up and be a comedian, right? Or can you?
Oh, yes, you can. Of course you can. Back in the 80s and the 90s, oh my God, Christine, I was performing at clubs as a road comic. And the owners of the clubs at the end of the week would say, do you want to get paid in cash or coke?
Wow. And you would often say...
Often? What do you mean often? Every time. Coke.
Oh, coke. Shit. Oh,
yeah,
shit.
Of course.
So did you have to go back to rehab for different drugs or just, okay, once for the drugs and alcohol and then once for the food or was it?
I never did rehab.
Because these are different addictions.
But they're all rooted in the same thing. They're all rooted in my mind and it's all about a thinking disease. So the food addiction is thinking you're not enough and you eat for emotional reasons. Alcohol and drugs says you're not enough or you're the best thing in the world and people don't live up to your standards. You're either a victim or the hero, but it's the same side of the same coin, different sides of the same coin. So for me, I had to go to treatment. I did go to treatment for alcohol and drugs because I needed it. I couldn't get far enough away from the needle. And what happened was, is I did 94 days in a treatment facility in West Hollywood. And that got me 94 days away from needles, injecting drugs into my system. And I needed that. Because on my own, I don't think I could have done it on my own. I needed all the help. Sure. And it was really odd because asking for help is so hard for many of us. It's hard for me to ask for help. I don't want to seem weak or that I need help or that I failed at something. It was the best decision I ever did was when I told that one person the truth and said, I need help. I'm an addict and alcoholic. I want to know what help was there. So if your listeners are struggling, know that help is there. You've just got to ask for it. People will move mountains to help you get clean and sober.
And so have you done that for others in terms of like being a sponsor to people? Is that one of your missions now? Or like, have you know, people well, often, I they'll mentor, go through something like this and then they'll turn it around. Yeah, to help others.
I mentor about 28 people.
Oh my gosh. And how do you do that?
My primary purpose is to stay sober and help someone else. And I'm really clear about that. It's more important than comedy. It's more important than because without my sobriety, I don't have comedy. Without my sobriety, there's no jobs. Without my sobriety, there's no relationship. Without my sobriety, there's no family and friends. So my sobriety has to come, has to be 10% of my life, but it has to be the first 10% of my life.
That's really interesting. Boy, that's an interesting way to look at it. Yeah, because you have to handle your disease every day.
Every day, you have to treat it. And for me, it's about going into a program of recovery, staying in that program, staying in the middle, staying connected, praying, meditating, and helping others.
Now, when you were on Celebrity Fit Club and making all that money, was that part mm-hmm. of the drug years or the sobriety years?
Drug years. I see photos of me like on the internet. On the set of that show. And I'm like, well, there's the picture of me. So I guess I really was there.
Wow. Do you have specific regrets on money you didn't invest or money that you blew? Because with all that money coming in, I mean, to think of the potential, or did you buy a lot of stuff? Did you buy a lot of homes and cars and stuff?
Well, I do own homes and cars now, still as sober. But, you know, I think probably all told, I probably pissed through about $1 million on drugs. Not just drugs itself, but like partying, the traveling to drugs, bringing friends with. So it's not like I bought $1 million worth of heroin and crystal meth. I didn't do that. But, you know, bringing friends along for the ride. And, you know, I mean, you know, I was young when I got sort of famous and they were throwing so much money at you and you've got no skills and no one teaches you how to do any of this stuff. They just sort of hand you millions of dollars and no one teaches you how to handle life when all of a sudden you're young and haven't had anything. And then all of a sudden you have everything. You know, that's why I see all these child stars struggle. And I get it. I wasn't a child star, thank God. But I understand why so many fall from grace and so many fall hard.
When you became sober, did you have to get rid of a lot of friends as or?
Yep. When I got sober, they told me I had to change one thing and that was everything.
Oh, shit. Really? That must have been really something else.
No. I was hanging out with lower. Actually, here's a funny story. I wasn't really even hanging out with lower companions. A friend of mine said, you know how you can tell? He goes, have you ever been in a room and you look to see who the lowest companion is? And I went, yeah. I go, I can never find it. And they're like, yeah, because you're the lowest. And I thought, well, fuck, somebody's got to be. That was always the case for me. I was the person that your parents said, don't hang out with him.
Oh, that was God, me. That's funny. I know what you mean, though. I was always kind of like, the black sheep in the way. You know what I mean? Like I remember a couple of guys I dated and their mothers hated me, you know, just hated me because they knew.
Why?
Well, they knew I would be the one who introduced their son to marijuana, or I would be the one to take chances, or I would be the one to drag him to a concert. I would be the one to stay up late. I would be the one, you know, who took the chances, who wasn't the conventional, you know, like you said, growing up in New Hampshire, obviously you were not conventional in that town, right?
No, not at all. And that was part of the problem for me was I didn't fit in and I didn't know what it was. Like I knew I was gay, but I didn't, that really wasn't it as well. I also liked the drinking and the drugging and the fast times. And I liked clubbing and, you know, I'm 16 years old going to clubs.
But that's the thing. And you and I are actually the same age. We're the exact same age. Yeah. And I think it was also part of when we grew up at that time, the people in New Hampshire, in Pittsburgh, where I grew up, they didn't have the vocabulary to try to assist us being creative people. You know what I mean? Because that didn't even,
exactly.
Nobody nurtured anybody.
We're artists.
Right.
No, we're artists, and people that don't understand artists considered us weird, and they wanted to put us on the fringe as opposed to celebrating our uniqueness and the talents that we have.
And they often, since they don't have the speech to talk and to conversate with us, they just leave. They back off and they just think, well, they'll figure it out. I don't know what they're doing. I don't know what Chrissy's doing out there in LA. I don't know. I mean, now my family's more on board, but I'm just saying, like, there's definitely.
I mean, look at the work product you put out. You put out this great work product. Now they can. Now it's something tangible for them.
Yeah, but in addition, now we have the internet, so things are more.
My mom did not think that I could make a living doing comedy. She's like, I don't know why you're wasting your life. And then I bought her first house, and that's what she needed to see in order for it to be tangible.
That is.
My friends were like, I don't know, you're gay, you're really gay. I don't know. Hollywood doesn't seem to embrace your types. You know, and I've been on The Tonight Show umpteen times. I've been on Howard Stern zillions of times. I've done, you know, I've done what most comedians would consider to be the penultimate of careers. And
you better believe it.
And I'm happy with that. And, you know, I did it on my terms pretty much, but at a great cost.
Well, it sounds like it. Now, you are clearly a survivor because you keep coming back. And
like a bad rash, I keep coming back.
You, now that you're sober, it seems like once you take seriously, you're brilliant. You're seriously brilliant. And with all that cloud of the drugs and the alcohol, once that's lifted, you can do anything. I mean, don't you feel, you must feel
I
like
do.
That. Yeah,
I do. You know, I'm in my twilight years. I'm fixing to retire soon. And, you know,
now wait a minute. Are you sure we're the same age? Because
we
I don't
are.
Feel twilight years.
I do. I've saved money. I've got property. I'm like, I don't know. I want to start enjoying like traveling. I want to enjoy maybe pick up painting or do something. You know, I don't know. I sort of have conquered everything I've ever wanted to do. And now I'm sort of like, my dog's getting older and, you know. I don't know. I'm thinking about settling down, which is so odd.
I hear you, but those are big words. Now, I think that what you probably also mean, though, is like go to Italy for a month and ride bikes and learn to paint like that, right?
Of course. Yes.
Okay. Well, that's what you might so-called retire, but you're not going to slow down.
No. I love doing comedy. So I don't consider comedy work.
Right, right. Comedians don't.
Yeah, I don't ever consider it work. So, you know, I'll go, you know, in Las Vegas, I'll get a call from a club. Hey, can you come down to a fallout spot? Of course.
Yeah. Here, yeah. Right on.
You know, here in LA, same thing. I still call in for spots when we were doing that. Now, who knows what's going to happen with that.
But. Hey, let me ask you, why did the people in the 70s, like when we were growing up, people had full bars in their houses, didn't they?
Full bars.
Why did they have that? I mean,
I remember my parents had schnapps, grenadine. They had all the mixers, sweet and sour, margaritas,
little club
drinks that you would just pour over ice. They were so gross. They had every vodka, every whiskey. Yeah.
Yeah. And like the crown bottle and the thing bottle.
In the purple, their crown bottle and that velvet purple bag it came in.
Yeah. And like Glenfiddich.
All of that stuff. Nowadays, do kid parents have that?
I don't think so. Now, I think it's more like beer and wine. But it's just funny. In the 70s, no matter whether you were rich or poor, you had a bar in your house. Everybody did.
You had a full bar, and it was always in the basement. Well, ours was in the basement.
Yeah.
Well, my dad even put posters of like girls up, and we had a Budweiser neon sign. Like he tried to make our basement look like a bar, actually. No wonder I'm an alcoholic, Christine. I just had a breakthrough on your show.
That is hilarious.
It's their fault.
We used to, though, and I'm sure you did this too. We'd take the vodka out of the bottle and fill it up with water. How many times do you do that?
Of course.
Of course. It's obvious.
All the time. And then then the best was when my parents would have a party.
Right.
And people would go, I'll have a vodka tonic. And my parents, who didn't drink, would fill the vodka and the tonic, and I would watch the people's faces, and they would take a sip and go, "This is the most watered down drink I've ever had," because there was no vodka left in the bottle.
That is hilarious. Your parents didn't drink. That's interesting. It wasn't in your house then. I mean, or it was. It was in your house, but they didn't drink.
It was in the house. They just didn't drink. They had it more for company.
Yeah. That was such a thing also.
We also had a living room the kids were not allowed in ever.
There you go.
We had my mom called it the parlor, and we were not allowed in that room. And they would beat us if we went into the room ever. There's a couch growing up that I never sat on, never once tried it, never once in my own house.
You weren't allowed because you weren't allowed.
Right. Didn't you have the same thing growing up? You know, you had the family room.
Yeah, we didn't because we were really poor, and there were eight of us in like 1,000 square feet. So there was very little space.
Oh, wow.
But the rich neighbors would have that. And yeah, that was a big deal. Like when I went babysitting.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, you go babysitting, they'd be showing you around and they'd say, "Oh, but you don't go in there."
Exactly.
You know, oh, obviously.
Yeah. It's a rug no one has ever stepped on, a couch no one's ever sat on. Yeah, there it is. It's a show place.
Just ridiculous. Just ridiculous. Hey, man, you didn't get the vaccine yet, did you?
No, not yet. But I plan on getting it as soon as they tell me I can.
Me too, man. I can't wait. I'm really ready.
I hope it brings us back to some sense of normalcy now because, you know, I'm getting a little cabin fever.
No kidding. Now, there are the restaurants are open again outside, but it is, you know, it's scary because since that hasn't happened in so long, like I was driving through Hollywood last night, the places outside are packed.
Yeah, I know. I just drove through West Hollywood yesterday. And there's this new restaurant, Bottega Louie, which is my favorite restaurant downtown. They opened up a location in West Hollywood, and their patio is packed.
Yeah.
Packed.
So I don't know how safe that is, but I am looking forward to it.
Well, it's outdoors.
Yeah, I know, but still a lot of people. Hey, have you been flying at all, or do you drive back and forth from Vegas?
No, I drive back and forth from Vegas, but I spent Thanksgiving in Fort Lauderdale. My best friend has a house there. So I spend every year Thanksgiving in Fort Lauderdale. So I flew LA Miami on American Airlines and had a great time. I was the only person, there was only two of us up in business class, and easy flight, no problems. We stuck to all the recommended guidelines, and
Wonderful.
I have friends that have had COVID and they're okay now. I mean, one of them had a really bad experience with it, but most of them are okay.
Good. Isn't it funny now flying as a former flight attendant? Don't you just laugh your ass off at them and stuff?
Oh my God. First of all, I love to tell the flight attendant, especially when I fly on American, because that was the airline I worked for.
I thought you worked for TWA.
TWA became American Airlines. So.
Oh God. I can't believe I forgot that.
Yeah. So, it's just interesting how when you tell them that you're a former flight attendant, they'll bring you wine to take off the plane. And I'm like, I'm sober. Damn it. Bring me those chocolate chip cookies instead.
Yeah, they do that though. And I was just telling a friend about that going to Australia, and the flight attendants gave us 4 bottles of champagne off the plane.
I know. They do that to me all the time and I don't drink.
Yeah, no.
So it's kind though.
But
so kind.
How about now they have cell phones and iPads, and we did not have that. And we were back. I would read like a novel a week. I was reading so much more.
Oh my God. My People magazine. You read novels. I read People and Star. I love the gossip.
Well, yeah. And the magazines that were in the plane as well.
Yeah.
But remember, like you'd land somewhere and then you'd have like a 35 minute turnaround and you'd run off the plane, run to
grab
the payphones. You knew all the payphones and all the airports.
Oh no. We're so different. I would run and grab something to eat.
Yeah, yeah.
I never ate airline food. Never ate airline food until I became a passenger.
What about like in first class? I remember on my airline, US Air.
You know, I applied to be a flight attendant for US Air and they hired me and I didn't take the job.
Oh.
This great recruiter named Carrie Olnicheki was the name of the recruiter. I'll never forget him. They wanted to base me in San Diego.
Oh, that would have been all right.
I didn't want to live down there.
It's just so funny how much we used to serve the food and how many times we'd go through with a cart.
We used to carve Chateaubriand in the aisle. And we would make Caesar salad with croutons and dressing. And I mean, we fucking slung some shit up there. Nowadays, they just bring a tray and throw it in front of you.
If even that. I remember in Coach, we would give away champagne or orange juice on the ground in these little plastic cups.
Yeah, I know.
Then we would give like hot towels to the entire plane.
Oh, wow. We never did that.
That was so gross.
We never did that.
That was so gross because people would be like washing their whole body.
They would be disgusting. You're going to make me throw up.
Then you'd walk through the aisle.
So
going,
gross.
Trash.
And it's a wonder why we didn't have COVID back then with all that disgusting.
I know. And we just said, trash, 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 trash.
I would look at people and go, you're trash, sir. Your daughter's trash, sir. Oh, and your wife's trash, sir.
Man, I would have liked to have flown with you. I bet you had a good time.
I was so mean. I was.
That's funny.
People would grab me as I was walking down the aisle and I would slap their hand and go, you paid for a seat and it wasn't this one.
That's
was really
funny,
mean.
Man. Yeah, I'm glad I had that career, but I'm also really glad I'm out of it because it was so redundant. Oh my God.
Me too.
Just the same thing in and out, and you couldn't grow from it. You know, you weren't going to get more money. It's just what they, you know, it was so.
But a 20-year flight attendant's making, you know, 100 grand. It's not bad.
Yeah, I know. But I'm just saying, like, you couldn't, it was all based on seniority. So, it just
or like, a language. If you spoke a language, you held the best lines.
Yeah, I know because you did it. Monsieur, merci beaucoup.
Monsieur, bonjour, comment ça va?
This has been so much fun talking to you, and I will thank Paul Lander for sure because I really wanted to connect you with you so long.
Oh please, I love. Thank you. It's been such a joy. Thanks for having me on your show, Chris.
You have a fabulous attitude and a fabulous outlook, and I'm so proud of all your accomplishments and getting through so much addiction.
Thank you, honey. I appreciate it.
All right, you guys, on behalf of Ant, one more time, please follow him over there on Twitter at AntComic and also follow me as well at StoryWorthy. All right, you guys, one more time on behalf of Ant. Thank you so much for coming on the show, man. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Christina. Reach out. I'd love to do your other stuff.
I will, for sure. My name is Christine Blackburn saying, make it a StoryWorthy week.
Thanks for joining us on the StoryWorthy podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to StoryWorthy on iTunes and visit the StoryWorthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.